The new issue of the interdisciplinary journal Social Research explores how the way we write and the meaning of writing are rapidly changing. It asks how artificial intelligence transforms norms and expectations that for centuries associated writing with voice, originality, and agency. If writing is a technology that restructures thought, as philosopher Walter Ong put it, then which written forms of thought and reflection will survive AI, or conversely, will be enabled by it? What new literacies are required? How will new technologies rework the relationship between writing and the marketplace? In 9 groundbreaking articles, the summer 2026 issue of the journal tackles these and other questions that pertain to the issue's title, Writing in the 21st Century. Social Research is the flagship journal of the New School for Social Research in New York City. You can find the journal on Project Muse or at www.socres.org. That is www.socres.org.
That's kind of conversation between the soul. That's conversation between the soul and the night.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade Derek Davison, and we are excited to bring you the news. But before we do, I've gotten some questions. If you join the Discord, you only get access to all of the channels if you are a subscriber. So just know that if you are not a subscriber, then you just get access to the general channel, and I mean paid subscriber. And also just to remind everyone about our weekly live streams, please go to our webpage on YouTube, American Prestige YouTube, and you could watch those live streams available to everyone after the fact. So please check those out.
I don't know that they're going to continue on Wednesdays, right? So we shouldn't tell people our Wednesday live chat, but it is a weekly live chat. We may be changing the schedule.
Because we may be doing basically more video specific content. We will keep you updated with that. All right, Derek, let's jump into the news. Let's start with Iran negotiations, and let's start with kind of hopeful signs of progress.
Yeah, unsurprisingly, it's kind of a mixed bag, but they did begin negotiations in Switzerland over the weekend after a couple of false starts. J.D. Vance turned up, Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf, the Speaker of the Iranian Parliament, turned up. So it was the high-level get-things-done teams that you would expect to be involved in serious negotiations. And that lasted for part of the day on Sunday. They started out and it took a few hours, but the Iranians eventually walked out of the venue. This seems to have been mostly for show. They didn't quit the negotiations. And in fact, there was a statement issued late Sunday or sort of overnight, Sunday into Monday, by the Pakistani and Qatari governments who were mediating, that two sides had agreed to a couple of preliminary steps. They'd agreed to form a committee to oversee the negotiations and their progress. They'd agreed to a deconfliction cell to monitor the so-called ceasefire in Lebanon, which is one of the reasons why the Iranians walked out or made a show of walking out earlier in the day. So they did make a little bit of progress on Sunday. That continued on into Monday then, and there were some real indications of progress. For example, the U.S. Treasury Department went ahead with its 60-day waiver on sanctions waiver on related to Iranian oil sales, which should allow the Iranians to sell oil freely on the world market for at least the next 60 days, as envisioned under the Memorandum of Understanding. There was also increased activity in the Strait of Hormuz, which people may recall late last week. Again, the Iranians said they were shutting down the Strait of Hormuz, also over the situation in Lebanon. So we'll get to Lebanon in a couple of minutes here. But there was some stepped up traffic in the Strait of Hormuz. So it seems that the Iranians are while they haven't formally announced that they're you know, reopening the strait or going back to, you know, where they were a few days ago, they haven't threatened any shipping going through. They sort of verbally threatened a couple of ships, I think, that have passed through, but haven't done anything militarily to seriously threaten them. So that's maybe, I don't know, reading the tea leaves, that could be an indication that they're trying not to interrupt what's happening in Switzerland. But mainly, yeah, the lifting of the oil sanctions is the one thing that seems to have indicated that they did make some progress. The principal negotiators, Galibaf and Vance and Abbas Araghchi, and I don't know about Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff, but those guys left, I think, Switzerland on Monday and left behind technical teams that stayed through Tuesday. They also seem to have made some progress. There was an agreement on some level, and we'll get to why this is, again, a mixed bag in a moment, on some level to free what Galibaf said was $12 billion. In frozen Iranian assets. Everybody just sort of hailed the progress that they made. Both sides seemed pleased-ish, you know, cautiously pleased, I guess. And this was an opening round of talks. So, you know, there's no expectation that any major achievements were going to take place. But they do seem to have set the table for future negotiations, which is, you know, pretty much what was expected.
Let's talk about the disputes that have been arising.
Yeah, the first one is over this frozen asset issue. As I mentioned, the Trump administration is pushing hard on the story that it is releasing or unfreezing these assets in Qatar or in cooperation with the Qatari government, at least $6 billion of them that will be used only to purchase agricultural products from the United States. So this is the Trump administration trying to say, no, actually, this war did achieve something for the American people. Now we've got Iran buying our agricultural products, and all you fine farmers out there can thank us later. But the Iranians have pushed back on that. A number of Iranian officials have insisted that no, Iran will decide where and how to spend its unfrozen assets. It's not on the United States to dictate the details of that or the terms of that. So that seems to be a bit of a dispute, that nothing major has come from it. Unlike the second dispute, which is the role of the International Atomic Energy Agency in the near future in terms of inspecting Iranian nuclear sites. This is starting to become a big deal, and it's because I think the two sides are just in different places regarding what is actually in the memorandum of understanding. The Trump administration is again insisting that Iran has agreed under the MOU to allow the IAEA back into Iran to allow inspectors to take a look at Iranian nuclear sites, maybe not to set up a regular inspections protocol again just yet, but to at least allow them to go in and take a look at these sites and see where, you know, the damage that's been done across, you know, two wars at this point, and just the state of the Iranian nuclear program. The Iranians have pushed back hard against that, insisting that they haven't agreed to anything of the sort. The IAEA itself, Rafael Grossi, who's the director, weighed in on Wednesday and took mostly the U.S. line, which is that Iran has at least de facto agreed to inspections under the MOU. I think the issue here is, again, differing interpretations of what's in the memorandum. There are things in the MOU that Iran is committed to do. They're basic outcomes, like we will not pursue a nuclear weapon, or we will resolve the disposition, is the language in the MOU, of the Iran's highly enriched uranium stockpile. These things can't be addressed really without IAEA involvement and oversight. So that could be interpreted as, you know, sort of the Iranians saying, yes, we will let the IAEA come back in and do its work. On the other hand, all the details about how you're going to get to those outcomes, how you're going to ensure that Iran, you know, verifiably, so the rest of the world doesn't start to look askance, isn't pursuing a nuclear weapon, and how Iran is going to dispose of its highly enriched uranium. None of the details of that have been worked out in the MOU. Obviously, they've been all kicked to these subsequent negotiations that are just started on Sunday. So from the Iranian perspective, I think the position is like, we haven't agreed to anything. We're supposed to discuss these things. And this could prove to be a major thing. Donald Trump has threatened to, you know, just walk away from the whole negotiation process if the Iranians don't basically say that, yes, we will allow the IAEA back in. He's not demanding like a timetable for inspections, but he does seem to be demanding that they at least acquiesce to allowing inspections. So this is another situation that this is a situation alongside Lebanon, which we'll get to, looks like a real early threat to sink the talks before they really get started.
Speaking of sinking, let's talk about the Strait of Hormuz. Nice.
The status of the Strait isn't entirely clear at the moment. As I said, late last week, the Iranians closed it. They announced that it was closed late in the week, over the weekend, primarily because of the situation in Lebanon. That has not stopped traffic from going through the Strait at levels that seem to be higher than what we were seeing during the war, or even during the blockade, the dueling blockades that followed that. So it hasn't been completely closed. There is maybe some, it varies by day, so there's maybe been some tapering off after the initial kind of, you know, flurry of excitement, but it really is unclear to what extent shipping companies are taking this new closure seriously, and the extent to which the Iranians are prepared to enforce it. They have, as I said, issued threats verbally, rhetorically, against ships transiting the Strait without Iranian permission. They have not taken any action in terms of, you know, firing shots at anything or something that severe. There are discussions apparently underway between the Omani and Iranian governments about administering the Strait now and in the future. We'll see how those go. Donald Trump is back to saying that the U.S. should impose fees on ships transiting the Strait for all the good work that the United States has done for the nations of the Middle East. I'm sure that'll go over well. So yeah, we're sort of in a place where it's unclear exactly where things stand, but I in terms of oil prices, in terms of the global market, prices are already back down to like pre-war levels, which is again something just insane level of optimism for the oil market. And even if the Iranians were to say tomorrow, okay, the closure's over, everybody go to it, the rate of shipping through the Strait is still not going to rise back to pre-war levels for quite some time to come. So it's a little weird. Still, the market is doing some bizarre things. There is a move underway by the UN, I should add, to get ships that have been stranded in the Persian Gulf during the war out. There are, according to the International Maritime Organization, around 11,000 crew members who are stuck in this situation, who need to be evacuated from the Gulf. So that seems to be underway. Again, not sure how what kind of coordination is going on there with the Iranians. I assume there is some, but that's the other Hormuz-related issue.
Thanks, Derek. Let's move on to Lebanon and let's talk about what's going on there. And let's begin with this reduction in fighting.
Yeah, this has been noticeable since the weekend. The ceasefire that was, you know, renewed for the, you know, fifth time or whatever it's been on Friday. The following day, after two really extensive days of violence, the IDF killed at least 83 people on Friday and at least 20 people on Saturday in Lebanon. But after that, late in the day on Saturday, it announced that it was shifting its forces to what it called a defensive posture within what it's euphemistically terming the security zone, i.e. its area of occupation in southern Lebanon. Israeli officials have insisted that there's no operational restriction on Israeli forces in Lebanon, but there has been a noticeable decline. There was, for a couple of days, no major incidents, as far as I know, by the IDF in Lebanon Sunday and Monday. That's changed over the last couple of days. They have killed they killed a couple of people on Tuesday, a couple of people on Wednesday. I haven't seen reporting on Thursday. You know, again, with the claim that Israeli forces are just defending themselves from potential threats, which rings a little hollow considering that, again, this is a military occupation of another country's territory. Even at that level, you know, a couple of people a day, one or two incidents per day, that's a marked decline in the level of violence. This is happening while another round of negotiations is going on between the Israeli and Lebanese governments. In the U.S., there's a lot of talk about securing at least a general Israeli proposal to eventually give up its occupation of southern Lebanon. There's no indication that the Israelis are actually going to go along with that. But there are discussions apparently about what the U.S. Has been pushing here, which is a proposal to create what they call pilot zones in southern Lebanon, where the Israeli military would pull back and the Lebanese army would come in and they would see what happens. I guess it's sort of a test of the Lebanese army to see if they can hold these places and prevent Hezbollah from establishing itself. That's very preliminary. But again, I think the Trump administration views this as a potential way out of what is still a very serious threat to the Iran talks. The longer that the Israelis continue to occupy Lebanon, the less tenable the ceasefire is going to be. And we've seen the Iranians multiple times now willing to walk away from the peace talks over the situation in Lebanon. So I think the administration is trying to find at least a slow way to ease tensions in Lebanon and maintain the peace process.
Thanks, Derek. Let's talk about Gaza and very grim news and a very grim story is Israel appears to be targeting children. So tell us what's going on there.
This is a new report from the UN Independent International Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territory, published a report on Tuesday, basically, yes, saying that the IDF has deliberately been targeting children in Gaza at genocidal levels. It's a component of the overall genocide. It's a genocide in itself. It found, you know, a very high number, high proportion of casualties in Gaza since October 7, 2023 have been children. That the IDF has intentionally targeted neonatal and maternity care facilities in Gaza, and that its humanitarian aid blockade has taken a disproportionate toll on children. So, yes, extremely grim, but in keeping with what I think people have been observing in Gaza all along, but just another international, you know, UN body that's making similar accusations of the Israelis.
Thank you, Derek. And let's also talk about the Board of Peace. Please give us an update on that.
There was a peace and drop site this week. Jeremy Scahill and Jawah Ahmed reporting based on documents that they'd seen passed back and forth between Hamas and the Board of Peace that basically make it clear that the Board of Peace, as I guess you would expect, is operating less as a mediator and more as an agent of the Israeli government. It is ignoring, in pushing for Hamas's disarmament, which is still the big sticking point in terms of moving forward with the so-called ceasefire roadmap. It is ignoring essentially the arguments from Hamas, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and other groups that disarmament has to be connected to a process of statehood for the Palestinians, and that they're not going to fully disarm without assurances that this ends with the Palestinian state, basically ignoring that and just demanding the Palestinians, not only that these factions disarm, but that they give up any right of resistance, that they, give up basically any hope of statehood just to keep things going here and avoid a return to the full-scale violence that we saw prior to this past October's, again, so-called ceasefire. So that's also grim. I don't think anybody had any expectation that the Board of Peace was actually going to try to be an objective party here and resolving this conflict. But certainly this is confirmation that they are not doing that, or seems to be confirmation anyway.
Thank you, Derek. Let's talk about the United Kingdom. We actually talked quite a bit about this on the live stream. If you want our more detailed analysis, check that out. But Derek, why don't you just tell us what happened with Keir Starmer resigning? I mean, that's
our friend Keir Starmer
resigned.
no longer going to have Keir Starmer to kick around. This was after Andy Burnham, the mayor of Greater Manchester and the number one challenger potentially to Starmer's leadership of the Labour Party and therefore his prime ministership, won the snap election that he ran in late last week to get into parliament, which you have to do to be a member of parliament to challenge for party leadership. So Burnham did that, won it pretty handily, actually. I think he outdid his polling in terms of margin of victory over the reform candidate who was the runner-up. And it's clear now that Burnham is going to challenge Starmer for party leadership. Starmer, reading the writing on the wall, announced his resignation on Monday. It looks like Burnham is going to be there's going to be a coronation here of Burnham as the party leader and prime minister. There's nobody else in the Labour Party has announced a definitive challenge for leadership. There are a few, I guess, Labour MPs who are considering it still, but they would have to get signatures, and it's not clear that there's any desire for a leadership contest at this point. So they may have a difficult time getting enough signatures to get on the ballot. The process here, if there are no other contenders, the process is on July 9th, the Labour Party will open up nominations for Starmer's replacement. And if Burnham is the only one, then he could become prime minister as soon as that following week, because they'll close the process and then just declare that he's the new leader of the party. If there's a contest, it could take a couple of months. Probably by September, you would see one of the candidates, whoever those might be, Burnham and whoever else, emerging as party leader and then prime minister. So that would take a little longer. And I think the party party members may be concerned about the dysfunction that would bring on if there's a 2 or 3 month period of limbo where you've got a lame duck prime minister, given how badly Labour is doing right now in terms of public image. I think they would prefer a smooth transition to Burnham and then, see what, take their chances with him, I guess.
Let's talk about North Korea, which might be back on Trump's radar.
This is based on a comment from South Korean President Lee Jae-myung, who said this week that on the sidelines of the G7 summit earlier this week, Donald Trump told him, I'm quoting here, "The time has come to pay attention to the North Korea issue," end quote. I'm assuming that's Lee's interpretation of what Trump said, because I can't imagine Donald Trump saying anything that coherent. So make of this what you will. Trump has invested very little energy in North Korea so far in his second term, which is odd given how much he trumpeted his great relationship with Kim Jong-un during his first term. But Kim likewise doesn't seem all that vermished about this. He's not really, trying to press the issue. He's got his relationship with Russia that's paying dividends for North Korea, seems to be paying quite a bit of dividends for North Korea. So he doesn't seem all that interested in reestablishing relations with Trump either. And so I don't know what this means. I don't know what it means that we're going to pay attention to the North Korea issue. It could be very bad. It's Trump, so who knows? But perhaps this means there's going to be some sort of outreach to Kim, and we could get another one of those great summits that didn't achieve anything like we got in the first term. It's just hard to say at this point.
I love a good summit. Let's move on to Sudan, where the battle over El Obeid, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, is still looming.
Yes. Sudanese military, the UN, the US, like international, the UN has done it several times at this point. The international community has been warning. We talked about this last week, has been warning for weeks about, or a couple of weeks at this point, about an imminent rapid support forces assault on El Obeid, which is the capital of North Kordofan state. It's home to hundreds of thousands of people, including many of them displaced, many people displaced from other parts of the Kordofan region by the RSF. So there's a potential here for a massacre of proportions that we haven't seen since Al-Fashir fell to the RSF, several months back, and the RSF's fighters engaged in what I think could credibly be described as genocidal behavior. There are deep fears of something like that happening here as well. The RSF has continued to bombard the city. It killed at least two people in a displaced persons camp around El Obeid earlier this week. The Sudanese military has been carrying out its own drone strikes around the city against RSF positions. We'll see what happens here. I mean, the RSF has massed a large force around El Obeid, presumably in advance of attacking the city. But whether it can actually pull that off remains to be seen. El Obeid is a little easier for the Sudanese military to get to and defend or reinforce if necessary than Al-Fashir was, certainly. And the RSF has taken some pretty heavy losses, mainly due to the uptick in drone strikes by the Sudanese military in this region. It remains to be seen whether they're actually in a position to take the city. But whether they do or do not take it, the risk of casualties is high. And if they do take it, the risk of some really terrible outcomes is quite high as well.
Let's go to Europe and let's talk about Trump, who seems to be angry with NATO again, and particularly his spat with Italian leader Meloni.
People probably followed this last week. Late last week, he told an Italian news outlet that Giorgia Meloni, the prime minister of Israel, was begging him to take a selfie with her during the G7 summit. Meloni got very angry at this. She called it totally fabricated. She criticized Trump for being a jerk, essentially, to U.S. allies, which, fair point, I guess. Italian foreign minister Antonio Tajani canceled a visit that he was supposed to make to the U.S. Over this spat. It's all indicative or symptomatic of the bigger issue, which is that Trump is back on his one of his moods about NATO. He's angry. He feels like the other NATO leaders were disloyal and not leaping into the Iran war when it became apparent that the U.S. didn't know what it was doing, that they didn't come to America's aid in that conflict, even though they did. Many of them allow the U.S. to use European military bases logistically to support the war. He's still mad about it. Mark Rutte, the NATO Secretary General and designated Trump ass kisser, was in Washington on Wednesday kissing Trump's ass again. There's a leader summit in Turkey next month, and everybody would like to avoid there being a scene there. So, they are trying to massage him on the one hand. Got Meloni, who for I think political reasons can't be seen doing that, but Rutte doesn't really have any political inclinations or any political reason not to suck up to Trump, and doesn't seem to have any self-respect either, so he's the perfect man for the job. It's unclear, though, whether Rutte's visit to the White House on Wednesday really achieved anything. Apparently, Trump spent most of the time they were there talking about how he's been beautifying Washington, D.C., fixed the reflecting pool before the damn terrorists started carving it up, how he put the National Guard on the streets and cleaned up crime and all the wonderful things he's been doing for Washington, D.C. I don't know that he really engaged with Rutte on the issue of NATO, but we'll see how things go next month, I guess, in Turkey.
Let's stay in Europe and let's talk about Russia and Ukraine. So, Derek, why don't you just start by giving us an update on the war?
Yeah, there's a couple of things to talk about here. One is the city of Kostyantynivka, which we've talked about before. The BBC reported this week that after interviews with Ukrainian soldiers, obviously, you know, remaining anonymous, that the city is no longer under Ukrainian control. As we've said in past episodes, Kostyantynivka is one of the four so-called fortress cities in Donetsk that are key to the Ukrainian defensive line in that province. The claim here in this BBC piece is that the Russian military is attempting to encircle it and has pushed deep enough into it that you really can't say that it's under Ukrainian control anymore. It's not under Russian control either. It's sort of in what the BBC called a gray zone, not really controlled by either side. But this is, as it sounds, a potential, potentially serious blow to the Ukrainian defensive line and what is left of Donetsk, or what is left of the Ukrainian-controlled portion of Donetsk. So, something to definitely keep monitoring. The other thing of note here is, again, to talk about the Ukrainian strikes in Russia and in Crimea. They've really been focusing heavily on Crimea for the last few weeks. They've knocked out power now to large parts of the peninsula. That was like Tuesday into Wednesday. There were blackouts in Sevastopol and other places. I don't know if they've restored power at this point or not. They've been striking bridges, fuel depots, logistically, in an effort to keep the Russian military from supporting its forces in mainland Ukraine via Crimea. The other notable incident this week was the Ukrainians struck a natural gas and helium processing facility, I think maybe Russia's largest natural gas processing facility, in the city of Orenburg. That's notable because Orenburg is about 1,200 kilometers behind the front line in eastern Ukraine. So it's another demonstration of this emerging long-range strike capability that the Ukrainians have. Again, is it going to be decisive in this conflict? I'm not sure you could say that, but still, I think of note.
Thanks, Derek. What about Poland stripping Zelensky of an award they gave him?
Yeah, the president of Poland, Karol Nawrocki, stripped Zelensky of the Order of the White Eagle last week. This was because Zelensky named a Ukrainian military unit Heroes of the UPA earlier this month. The UPA refers to the Ukrainian Insurgent Army, which was a Banderite guerrilla force that famously, or infamously, I guess, massacred tens of thousands of ethnic Poles during World War II. It was active in Ukraine during and after the war. As you might expect, this name is quite offensive from the Polish perspective, and so they stripped Zelensky of this honor. Several other Ukrainian presidents then, in solidarity with Zelensky, who've also received the Order of the White Eagle, sent their awards back to Poland. I don't know that this is going to have an effect on Poland's support for Ukraine or the European position on Ukraine, but it is a reminder, I think, that dredging up these histories is good for Zelensky politically in a domestic sense, but raises a lot of hairs on the backs of people's necks when he does it in other parts of Europe. So, I guess he knows what he's doing. I don't know that he knows what he's doing, actually, but this is another indication. Donald Tusk, who is the prime minister of Poland, who really is the one who is dealing, would be running, in charge of determining how much support Poland is going to be providing Ukraine. He disagreed with Nawrocki. They are on opposite sides of Polish politics anyway, but I think disagreed with the decision to strip Zelensky and the honor. And so that's why I say I don't think it's going to have much effect on the actual relationship. I will note, though, that Zelensky was supposed to go to Poland this week for a conference, a Ukraine reconstruction conference, and he's decided to skip that because of this spat. So, maybe it will turn into something bigger. Who knows?
Thank you, Derek. Let's talk about the Russians being mad at Trump.
Yeah, This was reported in the Financial Times this week, and other outlets picked up on it. But Sergey Lavrov made some kind of wry comments on Tuesday to the effect that the U.S. is, he said, stepping back from the role of an objective mediator. This came after there were reports coming out of the G7 summit last week that Trump was really impressed with these long-range Ukrainian attacks inside Russia. And, you know, the Russians took offense to this. They still think they have been thinking that they've got an understanding with Trump going all the way back to the Alaska summit with Vladimir Putin last year. Trump really sees things from their perspective in terms of the war, and that he's going to do what he can to kind of pressure Ukraine to a settlement. And they seem to be coming to a different conclusion now in the past few weeks. I think partly because Trump's attention has wandered to Iran and to other things. He's just bored with, I think, the Russia-Ukraine war. He can't seem to crack that nut, and he's tired of trying. But also then these reports coming out of the G7 summit that he was, you know, clapping like a trained seal at these reports of long-range strikes in Russia. And so the Russians are getting frustrated, and that just seems to be a growing factor here. We'll see if it manifests in any real way, but it's another thing to keep an eye on.
All right, let's come to our election lightning round, and let's start first with Colombia.
Colombia had its presidential runoff on Sunday. The right-wing candidate, Abelardo de la Espriella, won. Was a narrow victory. He finished about 1 point ahead of the leftist candidate, who was running with President Gustavo Petro's support, Ivan Cepeda. Cepeda conceded on Wednesday, so that would seem to affirm the victory. Prior to that, he and Petro had both said that they were unsure about the results and whether there'd been any tampering. Petro seemed to suggest, or Petro did suggest, that somebody had hacked or may have hacked the Colombian National Registry to play around with the results of the election. He pointed the finger toward the Israeli government. Who knows what to make of that? But with Cepeda having conceded now, I don't think there's much grounds left or any grounds left for him to challenge or for Petro to challenge the results. Espriella was endorsed by Donald Trump. He's promised to crack down on violent groups and, in the ways that other far right Latin American leaders have been doing or promising to do to varying degrees of, I guess we could say, success. I don't really know if that's a fair term to use, but he's also promised to restore Colombian relations or improve Colombia's relations with the U.S. and restore them with Israel. So, I guess they have that to look forward to.
Thank you, Derek. Let's talk about Peru.
This is another one where a very small margin in a presidential runoff is generating controversy. Keiko Fujimori maintains a less than 1% lead. I think there's still maybe a percentage or two of votes that need to be counted here. So it's still too soon to declare her the victory, but she does look like she's going to win. The second place candidate, Roberto Sanchez, declared on Tuesday that he is not going to accept the final result of this vote, alleging fraud. His campaign has been asserting that there are irregularities in the expatriate vote in particular. The expatriate vote ran heavily in Fujimori's direction. It was expected to, but still Sanchez is claiming that there's some shenanigans going on here and has demanded the annulment, potentially hundreds of thousands of overseas votes. Election officials have so far ignored or denied his petitions. But this could turn out to be a source of unrest in a country that is already pretty restive. So we'll see how it plays out. But again, Fujimori does look like she's going to be the next president of Peru.
Thanks, Derek. And let's wrap up our election lightning round with Ethiopia.
The Ethiopian government released the results on Sunday, I believe, of the country's June 1st parliamentary election. And as expected, it was a landslide victory for the Prosperity Party of Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. The results gave the party 438 seats in the House of People's Representatives. That is a 547-seat body under normal circumstances. These are not normal circumstances. The election wasn't held in the Tigray region and in parts of the Amhara and Oromia regions due to unrest. So that 438 is an even larger margin of the seats that were actually contested. The Prosperity won 90% of the seats that were contested, or roughly 90% of the seats that were contested in 2021 as well. And this is, they said, similar margin of victory, basically won around 90% of the seats that were up for grabs. I think the things to watch here is if Abiy decides to take his newly renewed electoral mandate and start a new conflict in Tigray, where the Tigray People's Liberation Front has been has kind of retaken control of the regional government and has been clashing in small instances with federal forces, and just in general kind of tensions are high there. Or if he decides to take it out and go looking for the Red Sea port that he has long desired, the Eritrean government in particular has been warning of the potential for a war, which could connect to the conflict in Tigray, given the geography and given the relationships between those parties. So two things to keep an eye out for now that the election is over.
Thanks, Derek. And let's conclude with really glorious news. We're ending on a high note this week, which is that Trump has revealed a new Air Force One plane.
Yes, his glorious $400 million Air Force One bribe or slash gift from the Qatari government. People may recall he got this plane from them last year. It finally got rolled out. It had to be, obviously refitted and turned into Air Force One. So it took some time to do that. They wanted to retire the previous Air Force One, and Trump rolled it out on Friday at Joint Base Andrews in Maryland. He said he was so happy with it. He said it boasts a level of luxury that nobody's ever seen before, which is what you want out of the plane that's carrying the President of the United States, is a level of luxury that nobody's ever seen before. I mean, he's got a hard job. He should live it up when he can. This is obviously corrupt, obviously seems like a bribe. It's going to stay with Trump after he leaves office. It's going to be what they're saying, donated to his presidential library. Basically, he'll just be, I guess, able to use it for his own purposes. But good for him. He needs a break. Donald Trump, he's done so much for us. He should enjoy his plane. I think that's fair.
Well, Derek, thank you so much. Everyone, thank you very much for listening. And as always, keep on rocking in the free world. Bye.